The wildfire season that ended a few weeks ago was not much of a fire season, at least when compared with recent years. Many people around the region still have bad memories of the destructive and smoky fire seasons of 2017 and 2018. And there will be more smoke. There has been some already since fire season ended, because now that the fire danger is down, forest managers can turn their attention to setting fires, controlled burns to keep fuels under control. Let's get some insight into the process from the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest. And look at that. I wrote down Rogue River National Forest. Some things never change. Rob Budge is Deputy Fire Staff for Fuels for the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest and a guest in the studio. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, and thanks for having me.
So has there been some burning already then?
There has. We actually started in right after October 1st. Last week, we did about 500 acres worth of burning on 4 out of our 5 ranger districts. Today, we have another 400 acres underway on our Wild Rivers Ranger District by Cave Junction. So we are off to a much better start than we've had in the last several years as far as accomplishments.
Was it pretty much a smooth transition? Were you able to go essentially straight from fire season staffing to controlled burn season?
We were. This year was very different for us. We were saying it's probably the first time since around 2012 or so that fire season actually ended and allowed us to roll right into prescribed fire season. Normally, we'd have people out on fire assignments still. We've been hosting fires until late in the year, so we're starting burning about a month or so earlier than we've been able to in the past.
A month early is that's highly unusual then.
It is. It's unusual for us, and it's an amazing opportunity because we get limited opportunities to burn.
So in a sense, do you have more to burn because of the fact that there was less that burned involuntarily during this fire season?
When we get a bad fire season that burns lots of acres, that doesn't necessarily affect how much we have scheduled for prescribed burning. Our prescribed fire projects are planned well in advance. Typically, they haven't been getting burned up in wildfires. So every year we have anywhere between 6,000 and 10,000 acres on the books ready to burn just if we get those window opportunities or those weather opportunities.
All right. So compared to the amount of acres that'll burn in fire season, prescribed burning is not a huge number, it sounds like.
No, we really need a much greater scale if we really want to make a difference.
So is there talk of then increasing that scale?
There is definitely talk of increasing the pace and scale. We have budget constraints just like everyone else. One of the issues we have here in Southwest Oregon is just with the amount of fuels that's out there. A lot of our units, we have to go in and actually cut the units, hand pile, and burn the hand piles, which is very labor intensive and expensive. Once we've gone in and done, that's our first entry, we call it. Once we've done that first entry, then we can go back and do underburning, which is a much lower cost because we don't have to do all the hand piling.
All right, but it sounds like none of these places then are going to get, and you're not going to just go out and lay a torch to a place that has gotten no prep work whatsoever.
That's correct. Yeah, if we do that, we'll end up damaging the residual stand, burn too hot, and it just causes all kinds of problems. So we're very careful to try to maintain an appropriate intensity for the fire.
So how much time and expense does it take to get these places prepped for fire? I mean, you have like a per acre cost of time and person hours?
We do. When we go out and do hand piling and burning, that can cost us $1,000 to $1,200 per acre. It's incredibly expensive. The farther away we are from roads, the more expensive it gets because we have to hike personnel in. We can't use some of the mechanized equipment, those type of things. Compare that with underburning after we've done that first entry. That can run anywhere from a couple $100 an acre to maybe $400 or $500 for an expensive unit. So it's definitely a fraction of the cost.
We're talking about prescribed burns with Rob Budge, who's Deputy Fire Staff Fuels for the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest based in Medford. You can join the conversation on the exchange. Everything you always wanted to know about controlled burns in national forests, join Rob on the phone at 800-838-3760 or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Now, the forest, as it's currently configured, I made the reference to Rogue River National Forest. It was Rogue River separately from Siskiyou. Now it's all Rogue River Siskiyou. So you got a forest that stretches from near Crater Lake to close to the ocean, so there must be some vastly different landscapes within that forest.
It is. And that's one of the big challenges we have. Total, we have about 1.8 million acres. We go all the way from Crater Lake, as you said, to the ocean. This is an incredibly diverse landscape as far as plants and animals. We get some really strange weather patterns, so it's a very complicated place to try to do prescribed burning.
Since it was once two forests, were there any particular differences in how the landscape was managed for burning between the Rogue River and the Siskiyou? Then, granted, it's been 17 years now since the merger, mm-hmm. so by now you might have had a chance to catch up.
Well, they were fairly similar as far as the intent for managing fire. The Siskiyou National Forest side of things is definitely much steeper country. There's not as many opportunities to use mechanized harvesters. Road access is kind of limited to what was there for the timber sales. The Rogue River side of the forest, which is our east side, still has rough terrain, but in comparison, it's easier country. So we can maybe we can use mechanized equipment in some more places. Access is a little better. But overall, they're pretty similar.
Okay. It seems like fairly often when we get into situations during fire season, when you hear about that place is too steep to get firefighters, and that's often what was the Siskiyou National Forest.
It is. But we also have parts on the Rogue River that are equally tough. And then the other thing we have is several wilderness areas, which really changes what we're allowed to do as far as management. There's some extra processes we have to follow. And so that's another challenge. And that's about 800,000 acres is just wilderness.
So, we're, you know, obviously people who are going into the wilderness areas for recreation are not allowed to bring certain things. Is that proscription land upon fire crews, too? Can they not bring in chainsaws and things
like
that? It does.
We can use chainsaws, helicopters, things like that in emergency situations. But if it's not an emergency, we try to maintain those wilderness values with using cross-cut saws and hand tools and things like that. But we do have an exemption process for a project that we really have to have the mechanized equipment.
All right. So back to the controlled burns then. I mean, how do you prioritize which areas will get the treatment and then the burning that follows that?
Well, the first filter we use is we try to do as much work as we can close to communities and residences. And that's trying to protect what we call the WUI or the wildland urban interface. So that's one of our first filters where we try to get work done. The next thing we try to do is if we've got like existing timber sales or roads and ridges that we connect, then we try to do prescribed burning to kind of connect those to utilize those natural features. And then we also will go out where there's been like timber sale activity or another management activity and just try to tag onto those projects. To get as much bang for the buck as we can.
So I see. In a case where you've got a timber sale that's gone on, you've already got some work done in the landscape that reduces the fuel load, so why not use that as part of a larger fire break?
That's exactly it. And then we also, there's a process in place where we can use some of the revenue generated from that timber sale to do fuels work in the sale area. So it also gives us some extra funding opportunities.
So then where across the landscape of the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest, with the filters you mentioned, close to people, timber sales, that sort of thing, where's most of the activity focused? Where's most of the focus on where you want to work if you haven't already?
Well, since about 2008, one of our major projects has been the Ashland Forest Resiliency Project. I'm sure your listeners are well aware of that mm-hmm. one. We also have work going on out in Upper Applegate Road in the Applegate. They were out burning this weekend there. Around Cave Junction, we have the Waters Creek area, which is a large one. We have Big Butte Springs Watershed on the High Cascades Ranger District. And then on the Gold Beach and Powers Ranger Districts, we have some roads and ridges we're doing work on over there. So every one of our five districts has fuels projects in some form.
Let's talk about Big Butte Springs, because that is a major water source. It's a watershed for the city of Medford, the Medford Water Commission, which then supplies it to towns all over the Rogue Valley. So how much treatment has that had over the years, and what kind of shape is that landscape in?
Over the years, there's been a fair amount of timber harvesting going on. We ran into some budget issues, so we haven't done as much prescribed burning as we would have liked to. But this year, we are waiting for the opportunity to do it's going to be around 350 to 400 acres of maintenance burning in the Big Butte Springs watershed this year, which is the first time in a few years we've been able to do that.
So again, we're talking to Rob Budge from the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest. He's Deputy Fire Staff Fuels, and we're talking about the whole process of prescribed burns or controlled burns, whatever you want to call them, going on around the National Forest this fall. There's a fairly extensive program. There's been some burning already, as you heard. More to come. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We talked about the fact that you have to prep these areas. You have to essentially cut and hand pile, then burn the hand piles. Then you can come back later on and do the undergrowth burns.
That's correct. And actually, it starts even before that. We have to go through the NEPA process, which is environmental assessment. Once we go through that and get approval for a project, Yes, we have to go in and either do hand thinning and piling or machine thinning, that type of thing. Have to go in and construct fire line around the burn units if there aren't roads or something to work off of. So yes, it's definitely quite a process to get these units ready to go. And a major part of that is writing what we call a burn plan, which is basically the set of conditions where we will go out and intentionally light a fire. And that has everything from what the resource objectives are, environmental conditions as far as winds, weather, what we want the fuel's conditions to be with fuel moistures, and all those types of things, so that we can do the best that we can to ensure we're going to have a successful burn.
The NEPA process, NEPA being the National Environmental Policy Act, either whether it's environmental assessment, the lesser of the two, or environmental impact statement, is still a public comment period and all that sort of stuff that goes in there. So is that correct?
Yes, it is. Yes.
So that's a fairly long process, I would think, just to be able to say, okay, here's what we want to do, and then finally get the approval to do it.
It is. You know, some of our projects can be 4, 5, even 10 years in the making. It's definitely a lengthy process.
How are the fires started?
The fires that we ignite?
Yeah.
We typically will use what we call drip torches, which is like a 1.5 gallon fuel can that has a mixture of diesel and unleaded gasoline in it. And it has a wick on the end. You light that, walk around the unit with fire crews, and we light fires that way. We use fusees, which are considered like road flares. Mm-hmm. And then this weekend, we had a helicopter in to use what we call a helitorch, which is basically a big drip torch that they hang underneath the helicopter. And we use that for some of the larger units or where we need to build up a lot of heat to meet objectives.
And that activity was around Applegate Lake?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. And that one was a good example, though, of we had everything in place and the unit was burning much hotter than we wanted it to. So we only burned about 5 acres and then decided this isn't the day for it. So we shut off the burn and we're going to wait for better weather conditions.
So talk about that then, because I mean, I can just imagine the variables that have to line up in order to make a decent controlled burn. You want the forest dry enough to burn, but wet enough to burn at a manageable rate, enough wind to carry the smoke away, but not too much wind to fan the flames. I mean, you got to thread some needles here, don't you?
We do. And also we have to make sure that the dead and down material on the ground is either dry enough to burn up or has enough moisture in it that we don't burn up everything. And then also we're always looking for when is the next moisture coming, because if we're entering a dry spell or a windy spell and we have a bunch of fire on the ground, you know, we have to hang on to that prescribed burn. So the weather forecast you read off earlier is what we really like to hear. We like to burn and then have it rain 2 or 3 days later. That's exactly what we're looking for.
But if it rains for 5 or 6 days later, do you then end up out of luck? Is your fuel then too moist to burn?
It potentially could be. This mm-hmm. time of year, we probably could get away with it. In another month or so, it could be a season ender for us.
And then talk about timing. I mean, when in the year is it just fall, or do you go fall, winter? Is there some actually in the spring too?
We do fall, winter, and spring. We like to burn in the fall as much as we can. That sometimes doesn't line up with what fire season's doing. In the wintertime, we have plenty of hand piles out there to burn, so we can actually burn piles when there's snow on the ground. And then in the springtime, we'll burn up until we get within a month or so of the start of fire season. But we do run that gamble in the spring of burning and then having to hang on to a fire, going into fire season if it's a really dry spring.
When you say hang on to a fire, what do you mean there?
Hold the fire in the unit that we mm-hmm. intend it to be in. Around here, typically, like when we get east wind events, that's been a cause of problems in years past. So we're just doing everything we can to make sure that prescribed burn stays where we intend it to.
Over the course of the winter, do you coordinate at all, in addition to all the other variables you're looking at, with the wood burning advisories for home wood burning? Do you look at those before you consider whether it's a burn day or not?
We certainly do. We follow the Oregon Smoke Management Plan, and the Oregon Department of Forestry has a smoke forecasting office that's in Salem. And they have to give their approval before we conduct any of our burns. So they issue a daily smoke forecast with some general instructions, and then we contact them with site-specific information for our larger units. And they're kind of the gatekeepers, we should say, as far as the smoke management goes.
Now, the state of Oregon did lighten up on some of its rules, didn't it, to allow more burning in non-fire season in the hope of having less smoke in fire season?
That's exactly it. And the intent was to try to make some more opportunities to burn. Some of the burn units we have, there's very few days during the year where all the conditions line up. And so, yes, the smoke management folks really they went the extra mile for us, trying to open things up as much as they can and give us as many opportunities as possible.
Does the work really pile up in some years? I mean, are you waiting for the perfect burn window that never arrives? I mean, can you wait sometimes a year, maybe two, before you get the right conditions on a particular unit?
That's exactly what happens, and it just creates backlog and more shelf stock. The flip side of that is sometimes you catch that magic year where every day is a good burn day, and then we can go out and burn a whole lot of acres very quickly. So it all averages out, but yes, some years are pretty tough for us.
And how do you let the public know in advance of burns about to happen?
We do our best to update our forest. We send out Twitter and Facebook updates. We do have a phone number for our dispatch office that has a recorded daily. These are the burn units that's planned. We have a couple other website locations where we put things, and then we try to do press releases for our larger burns.
Do you have the number off the top of your head for the dispatch?
Off the top of my head, I don't.
Okay. Well, we'll make sure that if you can get that back to me later in the day, we'll put it on our website to
sure
make sure
thing.
That people see that so they know they can call dispatch and find out. So there is a notification list, essentially, that people can get on if they sign up for the tweets, for example.
Yes, mm-hmm. That's correct.
There used to be slash burns in the heyday of the timber industry where the stuff that they left on the ground would get burned up. Do those still happen?
They do. That's another portion of the program that we have on the forest. Not only do we do fuels projects, but we do clean up after timber sales, and we refer to it as brush disposal.
Okay. Has the prescribed burning regime accelerated in recent years? I mean, given the needs of the forest in terms of reducing fuel loads,
In the time I've been on the forest, it's been a pretty constant number for us. We had a pretty large blip back in 2008 through 10. We got some of the economic stimulus money. But really, we come in at about that 6,000, 7,000 acre number most years.
But that's just a fraction, really, of what you have on the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest, right?
It is. But that's with the budget that we get. That's about what we can accomplish unless we get supplemental project dollars, which we do get. Yeah, funding is definitely an issue for us.
Is that pretty standard for a national forest anywhere in the country? I'm just wondering if there are any other places that get higher priority, therefore more funding, therefore get to burn more acres in a year.
Yeah, there are forests that have a lot lower costs. If you go east of the Cascades, prescribed burning is much lower cost over there. So you will see a lot larger numbers being put up by like the Fremont Wainema or the Malheur, some of those east side forests.
Because there's already a more spaced out landscape, less prep
and it's
time?
A little bit easier country. They can do larger units. Mm-hmm. Just the vegetation type, they have less undergrowth in mm-hmm. a lot of their areas.
Okay, down to our final thoughts then. What do you want to leave people with to what they should know about controlled burns going on over the course of the next three seasons?
I think the biggest thing that folks need to remember is we're doing the best we can. You know, we are doing everything we can to try to keep smoke out of the community. We're trying to get as many acres done on the ground as we can. If prescribed fire was easy, everybody would be doing it. There's definitely a lot of bits and pieces that have to fall into place to be successful.
All right. Thanks for the briefing on what's going on in prescribed burning season. Rob Budge is Deputy Fire Staff Fuels for the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest. Thanks for visiting the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
All right.